Hello and welcome to the Power of Cricket, the largest cricket podcast as far as size of the panel is concerned, usually. Welcome to the pod. This is Tariq, along with our usual gang, with one person missing this time again. We welcome back, though, Srinath. Hi, Srinath.
Hey, Tariq. Nice to be back.
And we have, as usual, Clive.
Hi, hey, Tariq.
And we also have Sameer, fresh from the Ed Sheeran concert. Hi, Sameer.
Hi, everyone.
And we are missing the clearest voice on the pod, both metaphorically and literally, Vinayak. So Vinayak is off this week, but we'll be back in the next episode. In the meantime, gentlemen, welcome to the Ashes special of Pod of Cricket. And we dive right into anticipating what we expect from the 70th edition of cricket's oldest rivalry, which gets underway in a couple of days. So just go around the table, maybe begin with Srinath. What kind of a contest are you expecting, given how chaotic the build-up has been for this particular edition?
Yeah, I think it's been harder on England than Australia. I mean, Australia, in popular opinion, seem to have invited some scorn upon themselves by picking a few controversial picks, to be very honest and fair to everybody. England, without Stokes, going to be very difficult. They're missing a talisman, not just in terms of bat and the ball, his presence itself. He was vice-captain before series, and a damn good fielder as well. So Stokes is a huge void for England. That's one big difference between the sides. And what I'm looking forward to, I mean, there's been a lot of trash talk, as happens usually before an Ashes, especially in Australia. England have hardly got any good practice in their three games, in the sense that quality of opposition hasn't been all that great. They've played entire first-class sides without a single first-class 100. They've played bowlers who've been completely green and nothing like what they're going to be facing. Well, Australia's players have had a good run in the Sheffield Shield over the first three rounds. So, in terms of preparation, there's no question as to who's better prepared. And missing Stokes, England go into this as complete underdogs. And key to winning for them, I think, just get away unscathed from the Gabba, because Australia haven't lost there in about 28, 29 years. And the one thing going for England here is, if Australia don't win at the Gabba, the chances of them winning a series is diminished significantly, as history suggests, over this quarter of a century. So, getting away without a loss from the Gabba should be England's first priority. And then, it's anybody's game. The day-night test, which sort of new for both sides. Australia have obviously played more. And then, they should take it from there. So, not as easy as it sounds, but that's what England need to do.
All right. And we go over to Sameer. Sameer, your take on what you are looking forward to in terms of the Ashes, specifically the contest. Again, this seems like a little bit of an un-contest, but are you sure about one side?
It's difficult to pick even a single side, looking at both the teams. Both the teams have had their own problems. If you look at Australia, they are playing at home conditions, and I guess that's probably the only thing which is in their support. Otherwise, even if you look at the Australian team, the selections they have made, I think much of the Australian batting lineup is going to be dependent on David Warner and Steve Smith, because there are like a lot of questionable selections. First of all, like Matt Renshaw's exclusion was completely surprising. While I did like the inclusion of Cameron Delport, but I was like really gutted with Renshaw's exclusion, because he was quite impressive in the short stints in the test matches he played. Then again,
Bancroft. That's Bancroft.
Yeah, sorry. Cameron Bancroft. And speaking about the compulsory Marsh quota in the Australian team, again, I don't know what has Sean Marsh got to offer in this comeback of his. Peter Anscombe maybe would be handy in the lower order, but again, Australian batting would be quite reliant on Warner and Smith. Talking about the English batting lineup, they are missing Ben Stokes. Alistair Cook didn't have much good form before the West Indies series, if you see. Even balance hasn't been quite in the best of his form. I think only Johnny Bairstow and maybe Joe Root looks better. And in the absence of Ben Stokes, I think England is going to struggle, and they will need him back, I think, after the Gabba test, or maybe after the one in Adelaide Oval. because without him, I don't think England has the potential to win the Ashes. Talking about their bowling lineup, again, flat pitches in Australia, it depends upon how James Anderson and Stuart Broad bowl in these conditions, because if these two bowlers fail, then I can't see England winning the Ashes. And talking about Australian side, I think they have got a good bowling lineup, and that's probably something where they have an edge on. So Mitchell Starc, Josh Hazlewood, Pat Cummins, they have like a three speedster type of bowling lineup. So I guess maybe, you know, a slightly that Australia holds the edge playing under home in home conditions, and you know, having a good bowling lineup and a much better setup compared to the England team.
All right, and we go over to Clive, quickly, your take on what you're anticipating.
Well, first of all, you know, the Australian team, even though their selection has been really dodgy, it's a usual selection thing that whenever there's any trouble or whenever there's any sort of issue, they go back onto unknown quantities for like to fall back on. The last time when they lost to South Africa, they blooded in all these new players. They got, that's how they got Renshaw and Hanscom, and they did perform well, but those were punts which actually worked well for them. This time around, they have dropped Renshaw, and dropping Renshaw was, you know, it was unfair on him given how he has done in his previous test in Australia. But then you had Cameron Bancroft scoring runs for Western for his side in the Sheffield Shield, and you look at Tim Payne. First of all, I don't think Tim Payne is the best wicketkeeper batsman in Australia. He might be the best wicketkeeper, but he doesn't provide much with the batting. While Peter Neville, who has been picked for Cricket New South Wales, has been scoring some runs here and there and looks much more, you know, more suited to the game of Test cricket. So that's one thing. But the rest of the Australian side is pretty strong. I don't think so any of the dodgy selections such as Payne or Bancroft will be the talking points during the first two tests in Gabba and Adelaide. But they have going, like the remaining players like Warner, Smith, Hanscom, Starc, Hazlewood, they're going to play a major part for Australia in the series as well. And coming to England, well, England, first of all, losing Stokes was one big hit, as Srinath said. And the rest of the side, it looks pretty undercooked, to say the least. Like, James Vince, even though he has impressive domestic or county records, people tend to forget that that comes in Division 2 cricket, where the quality of competition is not as good as Division 1. And definitely not, you can't compare the two between Test cricket and Division 2. While the rest of the players, again, Root and Cook will be vital. And for England to, you know, even have a fighting chance, it all depends on Anderson and Stokes and how skillful they are on these dead pitches. Because they're not going to find swing. They don't have that. They don't have pace, express pace like Hazlewood can generate or Starc can generate. It just depends on how well they can use their skill set to get their wickets. So that's one thing which will be a talking point in the series and a note, or could be a difference between the two sides.
Okay, and I think I kind of agree with Clive there that Australia sort of had the quality despite whatever controversial selections and picks have come into the picture. They have far too much quality to probably make this happen. Let's not forget that Australia are the team that will have to try and win back the Ashes, because England is the team that's holding them right now. And that's where probably they'll have to put the onus on. Probably, I would not say aggressive cricket, but at least proactive cricket in terms of going out and getting that win early. Like Srinath mentioned, especially since it's beginning at a venue like the Gabba, where traditionally Australia have been near about invincible. So that's how this shapes up. One player, none of you have mentioned as far as England go. Anybody has a take on Chris Wokes?
I'd like to tell about Chris Wokes. In the absence of Ben Stokes, I guess Chris Wokes is going to be an important part of the England setup, and you know, he will be the one who'll have to set up it. He'll have to step up with both the bat and the ball as well. And of course, he's going to begin as a certainty in the English lineup. So I guess Chris Wokes is going to be vital for England in the absence of Ben Stokes.
Yeah, well, I just agree with Sameer that, you know, along with Chris Wokes, even Moeen Ali. Now, Moeen Ali and Chris Wokes have to do the job of what Ben Stokes. They need to add a bit more with the ball, with the bat, and, you know, make up for what a Ben Stokes has cost England effectively. So I think both Chris Wokes is no Ben Stokes, clearly, but if Moeen Ali and Chris Wokes work together, they can bridge that gap. So that's what their aim should be for now.
Okay, so the combination of the two could kind of fill some of the gaps. We are going to get to a stage where we might look at more specific predictions, despite our history. But nonetheless, in the meantime, among the tests, any particular tests that you are looking forward to the most in terms of how competitive or exciting it could be as a contest? Because Australian tests, let's face it, have sort of lost a little bit of their luster over the last few seasons, mainly thanks to batting dominated pitches. Anybody looking forward to the day night test?
Yeah, all of us, I think. just considering both the pace attacks, I think should be great to watch them slug it out in a day-night test, specifically because, you know, in the evening, balls tended to do a bit, especially in Adelaide, in the tests that we've seen over the last couple of years. So somebody like Wokes, for example, you mentioned, could come in during those sorts of periods. And I think Australia specifically picked Chad Sayers, who's an Adelaide boy, plays for South Australia, and he's got a good record in day-night games with the Sheffield Shield. So, battle of the pace attacks in the pink ball test, I think, could be really interesting to watch. I mean, and more so, small mercies, it's going to start in a time that's conducive for us Indian watchers for that as well. So, Adelaide, for sure.
Okay. And Clive and Sameer, any picks that you have?
I will be really looking forward to the day-night test. Actually, I just love any day-night test. You know, the proposition is, it's something new. It's offer something new, so it's just very exciting to watch on its own. Okay, but I think the day-night test, as you know, Sriraj mentioned earlier in the start, that if England somehow survive Brisbane Gabba, then what happens is England will feel they fancy a chance in Adelaide, because Adelaide is their best chance, you know, to win a game, because the conditions will be suiting seamers. So whatever happens, England will feel more at home in Adelaide in those during the twilight sessions, and that's where, you know, it's their best chance to win. So I think that will be the most even test of the series, most probably because of the conditions on offer. So, and that's one test I'm looking forward to. And the other test I'm looking forward to is the Sydney test, because the Sydney test is like the New Year test, and it has a lot of history attached to it anyways, in the sense. So if there's an all probable chance, you could see an Australia whitewash over there, or a drawn series being won over there. So that's another test I'm looking forward to.
Alright, and if you ask me, I'm looking forward to the one. Obviously, the day-night test, I think we're more or less unanimous about that one. Saying that in terms of the day-night test, if the New Zealand test is anything to go by from a couple of seasons ago, I think we should expect some real drama in the day-night test. So, and just for the sake of the aesthetics that it brings in terms of the contrast of the day versus the night, both in terms of technique and in terms of how it looks. So that should be interesting. Sameer, your anticipated test.
I think Adelaide, playing the day-night test, Adelaide Oval is going to be England's best chance in the series throughout. Because if they bowl at the right time, I guess England can win Adelaide. They may not win Gabba, they may not win in Sydney, they might not win in Perth as well. But Adelaide, I think England has a far better edge than Australia, because they're going to play in day-night conditions. Also, with the possibility that maybe Stokes might be back by that time, I feel, you know, England has a real chance in Adelaide. Talking about the Boxing Day test, I just have a feeling, you know, that this series will already be decided by the time both teams go to Sydney. I don't know whose favour, but we will surely know that, you know, like, the series is like, the Ashes is going to go to this country by the start of the Sydney test.
Great. So we have two predictions. So I'm pretty sure now England is going to lose by an innings in Adelaide, and the series will be decided at Sydney.
But actually, I'm surprised. No, I forgot about it. That no one is excited about the last Ashes Test in at Wacker.
I was, before I handed over to Samir, I was actually going to add that one of the tests I'm looking forward to really for sentimental reasons is the one in Tobaka, because it's the last test there. And I hope they make the fastest pitch that they've ever beat there. I don't know if they will, but ideally that would be the perfect send off.
Nostalgia.
No, but I think...
with cracks...
But I'll definitely be singing le kill for sure.
Okay, and now that we are done going down the table about our opinions, shall we dive into the question bag? Because we sent out a tweet asking for questions from listeners, and we have got quite a few. So, gentlemen, are you ready to dive into the Ashes mailbag and look up?
Bring it on.
Alright. So, since we were talking about the WACA, let's begin with a question there. Sahil Balla at IM Sahil Balla asks that, could you please talk about the death of the WACA? Last ever test match to be played there before they moved to the new Perth Stadium or the multi-sport venue. Just a quick note from somebody on the panel about the death of the WACA, or how that makes
it. Yeah, I have something. The shift, WACA was the last, you know, complete, only cricket stadium left in Australia, if I'm not wrong, because it's now the SCG, MCG, Adelaide Oval, they're all multi-sport stadiums. Even the GABA stadium is also a multi-sport. Yeah, so... what WACA had was very special was that it was only a cricket-specific stadium, and that also now is gone. And it is completely... I understand, you know, the economic feasibility about it, that you can't run just a cricket stadium for like 4 months, for at least you can't run a stadium for one test, one ODI, and at least five... If Perth Scorchers continue going to the final six T20 games a year. So it's not feasible enough, I understand that. But it's just sad, you know, to see that a venue which holds so much is going to shift stadiums, and that to a multi-sport venue where you're going to have drop-in pitches. And as we all know, drop-in pitches are more or less having the uniform factor. Like the Melbourne pitch, Adelaide pitch, Sydney pitch, they are more or less almost similar now. Actually, the Sydney pitch is still not a drop-in pitch. It still is a pitch which is maintained by the Sydney Cricket Ground. But all these pitches are becoming similar day by day, and the unique properties of a GABA pitch, fast, bouncy, those are some things which are going to go missing once we move to the new stadium. So that's something which I am sad about. Western Australia, you're always looking to find a feasible way for your stadium, and moving to a multi-sort venue now makes sense given how you want your stadium to be used all throughout the year.
Alright. To what Clive said about the WACA, from an Indian perspective, it's a special venue as well.
It's the last test win in Australia we had.
Oh my god. We last won in 2008.
We haven't won a test match in Australia since then.
Since then, yes. But nonetheless, I mean, a couple of special performances there. Of course, Sachin Tendulkar's 100 back in the 92 series was another highlight. Icon-wise, it will probably be missed, but Mohsin Pandey, like Clive mentioned, one of the critical things that will be missed is its singularly unique character of basically being one of the fastest pitches anywhere. It'll be hard to see another pitch that has had such a consistent feature over its entire lifetime. I mean, I know that the Perth pitch has sometimes produced absolute batting beauties as well, but it still remained fast no matter what happened. That character will probably be missed the most.
I think that is just one last point to add. I think the Wacker pitch is the cricketing equivalent of any score on a cold Monday night in Stoke. I mean, whenever somebody scores runs anywhere in the world, the first question everybody asks is, but can he score at Wacker against an Australian attack? I mean, all your runs, whatever you've done in your life, didn't matter. The next question to be asked, can he perform there? I think that's probably a very unique characteristic of the Wacker pitch. The first thing people thought about when they spoke fast bowling and they spoke of a pitch that was conducive to the batsmen.
Yes, and that's exactly why I brought up the Sachin Tendulkar point, because it went a long way in terms of making his career or building that reputation and the myths and the mythology around him in terms of the talent and the batting.
Even during 2008, I remember Tendulkar did 50 in Perth, even during the 2008, if anyone remembers.
Yes, I think he did, because at that time we had four batsmen scoring 50 innings, I think, apart from...
No. But I remember, like, maybe Rahul Dravid was there, I don't remember, but I remember Sachin Tendulkar scoring a 50 in the Perth game, which India won.
Yes, and that too broke both a long-standing Australian record in terms of the record at the venue. Plus,
we are definitely living up to the name Pod of Cricket. Ashes preview, talk of Tendulkar. So, I think we're going to get back to
the task at hand. The next question is a fairly obvious one, but one that we might want to just quickly deal with. Samyak Sivashish, that is at Samyak Sivashish, asks, what is your take on the entire Stokes placa? Should he be allowed back into the squad? He's talking about cricket versus morality. And in case he is, how much of a game-changing role can he play, given that he hasn't played much in the recent times?
Since the incident, the morality incident you're speaking about, didn't happen inside the cricket field, and also there are, you know, exceptions. Maybe he wasn't actually responsible for what happened, or, you know, like he did the right thing or something. I feel, you know, he should be completely allowed to play. I don't think there's a question on that. Speaking about his the game-changing thing he can make if he plays for England, of course, we have spoken about it throughout the pod, that if Ben Stokes can, you know, just edge this series towards England if he gets to play, not the first test, of course, but, you know, in the later stages, if he comes in and, you know, it is surely going to, you know, gear up the England side. Because he can be an asset to the batting as well as the bowling lineup. That's why.
Like anybody else has a take on the whether or not he should be allowed back into the side?
I think it completely depends on what the police proceedings happen. BCD have come out and said he's in a holding pattern, which means that they're basically waiting for confirmation from the police in Bristol to sort of acquit him of the whole thing and not charge him further. I think as long as those charges are clear, I think the board will automatically approve of his place in the side. Because for now, they've been non-committal about his participation. They've said they're awaiting what the police say is the right thing to do. But I think outside of that, as long as the law deems whatever he's done or to not be of any illegal or moral consequences to him, I think after that, it's a pretty simple question whether he should be coming back, because, like Samir rightly pointed out, he's not done anything on the field to warrant not being picked for England. So as long as the outside circumstances allow, Stokes slots straight back into the team. I mean, if you remove the video evidence and if none of this came out, he was just somebody, it was just another night out that would have gone unnoticed. So now that there is evidence, there is an investigation, all of the processes are being followed. So as long as he's being acquitted officially from the police department and the judiciary side of things, there's no reason why he shouldn't come back. Impact-wise, I think we've said everything that is to be said. Huge, huge player for England, and he's launched back to the 11.
All right. And quick opinion from you, Clive, on this?
Yeah, I have the same thing as Srinath as well. Same opinion. If he's guilty, then he suffers, you know, the punishment, whatever punishment is there for the crime. And if he's not guilty, it's simple. He just comes back to the field of cricket. Like, we have seen players come back for doing much more worse on the field of cricket. Like, let's not talk about, like, spot fixing, for example. They're still playing cricket right now. So what Ben Stokes has done is off the field. And if he's guilty, he will pay for it. he'll pay for the jail time, whatever the punishment be. But there's no questions about him coming back and playing for England as such, and about his impact. Well, we all know like what he provides balance to the English side and what an impact he can have if he gets going. So there's no questions about his impact as well.
All right. And I sort of more or less agree there, because we otherwise are casting aspersions on the rule of law and the basic process of law if we are trying to make our own decisions on the morality and things like that. This is something that is being handled by the relevant authorities. Doesn't look like that comes into the picture at all. It's just a straightforward question of what they decide at the end, and the decision by itself then results in whether he comes back into the side or not. Okay, time to move on to the next question, gentlemen. The next question comes from Varun Parkal. At Varun Parkal, he's asking, and I would ask you to speak one and only one particular player here. He's asking, who will be the X factor for both teams? The question's framed a little ambiguously. I don't think there'll be one player who will be the X factor for both teams, but I guess he means one player each from each team who will be the real impact players. And we leave Stokes out because he is not in there.
I think for England, it will either be Moeen Ali or Alistair Cook, because Moeen Ali with the ball can do some damage as well, because even though if it's Australia and he's a spinner, but people tend to not take him seriously with the ball, and I feel Australia will do the same as well. And with the bat, he has shown he has the ability to change the game in a session as well, like not the same at the same level as Stokes, but he can do some damage as well. And for Australia,
that's X and Y factor for England.
Yeah. And for Australia, I think the only one I actually see doing well is the X factor, something out of the box, is Peter Hanscom. He bats differently. That's one. And there's nothing else I actually need to add about him. He's been scoring runs as well.
All right. Srinath, your picks for the X factor?
I'm going with Josh Hazlewood for Australia. I think looking at all the three bowlers, they're all pretty much strike bowlers, but Hazlewood sort of earned his reputation as the most consistent fast bowler. I think Nathan Lyon somewhat has spoken that he's happy for every media house to put this as a headline, that he thinks Josh Hazlewood is the best fast bowler in the world. Might not be way too off the mark, but exaggerations aside, I think consistency is sort of key to getting Australia the big wickets, either by virtue of wickets happening at the other end or he himself picking up wickets. And Josh Hazlewood is just consistency and what he brings to the team, especially considering this brittle core that England have. The number of players who are playing their first series, they don't have too much experience of mixing them apart from Cook and Root. So I think Hazlewood for Australia. For England, I think fairly obvious pick, but it's Alistair Cook for England, because he's made about 1,500 runs from around 30 tests against Australia. I think it's six Ashes series, if I'm not wrong. And the interesting part is 766 is almost half of the runs that he scored in the Ashes came in a single series in Australia 2011. Which means, aside from that, he's had a fairly ordinary run against Australia, both home and away. So, considering what's to follow him, considering the Stoneman, who is a bit of a new opening partner for him, and whatever is in the middle order with Malan or Balance, whoever plays, Cook's presence at the top is crucial for England, and how he negotiates this triumvirate of fast bowlers that Australia are going to throw at them. Alistair Cook's probably going to be the difference maker for England, and it depends on how he goes.
All right. And Sameer, your picks.
Well, I think looking at the way Johnny Bairstow has batted in all the formats, not just in the test matches, but even in the ODIs this year and the T20s, I guess, you know, this Ashes is going to be a sort of, you know, break for him where, you know, he can create a big impact. As for Australia, I was going to choose Peter Hanscom, but since Clive already chose him, I will, you know, expect at least once in my life I get to see Sean Marsh doing something really extraordinary and, you know, being remembered for it. So I'm going with the, you know, the not so obvious choice, Sean Marsh for Australia and Johnny Bairstow for England.
All right. And as far as I'm concerned, I'd probably go with Chris Woakes for England, because I just have this feeling that he could just come together in terms of conditions, in terms of his own impact, and could really become a key element for England to exploit any weaknesses in the Australian batting order. Australia have shown this tendency of sometimes becoming wobbly despite whatever talent they have at their disposal. So Chris Woakes from England. And on the Australian side, I don't know if he's mentioned him, because it's either it's probably expected that he will do well, or he's somebody who has to deliver. But I would probably think Steve Smith is kind of flying under the radar at the moment, despite whatever discussions going on. So I see him possibly making a big impact with the bat, because somehow in Australia he tends to bring some kind of a rabbit out of the hat. So I would probably wager on him to make some kind of a difference in a crucial point in one of the tests, or at least a couple of them actually.
Tarek, I feel Steve Smith and Joe Root are going to be the obvious choices. So we know, like, these two are going to be the elements, trying to create the element in the test match.
Oh, but I think this time Steve Smith might actually be the more underrated element, because he's been
the subcontinent. The
siege and given his recent subcontinental
quote-unquote
misadventures. He's probably not very high in confidence, so this is probably his time to stand up.
Probably a couple of brain fades as well.
He has some amends to make from the last Ashes as well. All right, so we'll move into one last main question. This one we are directing at you, Srinath, because you are probably best placed to answer it. This comes from Tim Part at Batting Tim. He asks, what about the Sheffield Shield test hierarchy confusion, because Tasmania want a younger squad, so they leave Team Payne out, but when included as a batsman, they delay a declaration and squander a winning position at the behest of Cricket Australia. Of course, you've spoken about Cricket Australia picking Team Payne out of nowhere. He ends the tweet with WTF question mark. So Srinath, WTF question mark.
No, I think he sort of answered his own question, to be fair. It's sort of the biggest problem with Cricket Australia, despite there being logic. I mean, there is a lot of logic with each and every selection. They could all be proven right, but there seems to be an element of hypocrisy which is being kind of directed at them based on whatever they've said in the past. Tim Payne specifically as a case, if you just look at whatever Australia selection team has said in the past, they've always wanted youth, they want somebody picking it up from the older generation, and yet they turn to Sean Marsh. I mean, Sean Marsh is 34, he's played 23 tests over a period of 8 years, he's had comeback after comeback. Then similarly with Tim Payne, they're looking at somebody to replace Matthew Wade. They were looking at options like Alex Carey, who's among the highly rated wicketkeepers going around in Australia. Bancroft himself keeps, I mean, he's pretty much kept with wicket. Most of the time he's played for Western Australia. He's also a good fielder, silly point, but the point remains that Bancroft could have kept wicket in his debut test. That would have been a possibility. It would have allowed him to play another batsman along with Marsh at seven, probably an all-rounder maybe. There are a lot of others in contention. Glenn Maxwell has been around. He's the incumbent. He's been shot out. There's all sorts of team combinations that could have been possible. And yet they've gone for Tim Payne, who's in his mid-30s now, and he's not made runs consistently over a long time. I mean, everyone would have seen it by now, but there's a stat nugget that Dan Lehman, Australia's coach, has scored a more decent first-class 100 than Tim Payne. I mean, a wicketkeeper need not necessarily score 100, that's besides the point, but it's about making consistent runs. I think Tim Part, who's asked this question, is spot on here when he says that Tasmania recently is pointing out to a game where Matthew Wade was keeping wicket and Tim Payne was batting. They delayed the declaration so that Tim Payne could bat longer. Then they picked him for the Cricket Australia 11. They gave him the exposure he needed. game time needed against England. So it all seems a bit contrived in terms of selectors sticking to a plan that they have in mind. There's absolutely nothing wrong in picking older players. There shouldn't be anything against them, but it's just a big tinge of hypocrisy in terms of what they've been preaching over the years in terms of wanting to breed young talent. Last year, they brought in Nick Madison, downed him after 3 games. Just an example of the number of number 6s and 7s that Australia have played in the recent past. So eventually, it all comes down to what you said in the past versus what your actions are, and that way the Australian selectors haven't done themselves a favour. I think WTF at the end is sort of a fair conclusion if you're an Australia fan.
Okay. And we are almost out of time, but we have time for one last question. And this is a very high-stakes question from Anish Anand at Test Bowler. He is asking, what is your prediction for the series? He says, I know you guys, whatever you guys predict, the opposite will happen. But nonetheless, what is your prediction for the series? So, guys, this is the moment of truth.
Okay. I, being the brave one, will go ahead first only. I feel Australia. Now, the margin depends upon how well England perform. Considering that Ben Stokes doesn't play, I feel Australia will win it either 2-1 or 3-1. And I wouldn't be surprised if England failed to win a single test without Ben Stokes. And I'll go with Australia. That's it. That's going to be my prediction.
All right. Srinath.
I was going to say Australia to get relegated. But whatever. but yeah, it's hard to see beyond Australia. I think they'll do enough to regain the Ashes. Right? I mean, they'll win more tests than England for sure. Margin depends on whether Stokes there. If Stokes there, then maybe by a single test. If Stokes is not there, margin will be better.
Okay, but my prediction is going to be that the series will start in Brisbane and end in Sydney. That's the safest prediction ever.
I'll pray it's going to end before Sydney, I'm telling you.
All right, so Sameer is very adamant that it's going to end before Sydney.
I don't know.
What about you?
I'll be the contrarian here because I just have this feeling that given the amount of chaos and uncertainty, there is somehow going to be a result which goes England's way and we end up with either a 2-1 England's way or something of that sort. And it's England who gets to take the Ashes back, or rather retain them from here. Because I somehow do not see Australia being able to, especially if it's like an early blow. Like you guys mentioned at the top of the podcast, the Brisbane test is such a crucial test, not just because it's the opener, but because it's at Brisbane. And if England can do something there, specifically win that, I'm wagering that England just edge Australia out in this. So
that means someone in the pod is going to be right this time.
Christ is already right because he's gone with the safest possible prediction. Anyway, that brings us right to the end of this Ashes special preview podcast because we will have a lot to talk about the Ashes and the series goes on. We'll bring you a mid-Ashes wrap and then, of course, an Ashes wrap once the series ends. In the meantime, you can look us up on Twitter at Pod of Cricket. You can send us questions again like these guys did this time for the episode. Other than that, you can visit our channel on Audio Boom, search for us under Pod of Cricket, or you can subscribe to us on iTunes or Pocket Cast or any other podcasting platform that you use. In the meantime, that's all we have time for this Ashes special edition of Pod of Cricket. Playing off along with Clive.
Bye, guys.
Srinath.
See you, thanks, Tariq.
And Sameer.
Thank you, Tariq.
And this is Tariq signing off from the Ashes Pod of Cricket special.